The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Today, we're going to talk about the structure of the soul, if we could use such terminology. The way this follows in terms of what we did yesterday, is yesterday we discussed how the normative way we know things is not applicable when we're talking about God. And that we need to adopt a different way of knowing. God is not an object amongst objects, not a being amongst being. All time, space, and being are a function of God. Everything else that we understand is in terms of time, space, and being. But God, who is the source of time, space, and being, the context of time, space, and being, cannot be expected to be understood through that terminology. But that's the way we generally understand things. Right? We also discussed how not only is our terminology invalid, but the nature of the relationship that we have when we understand something is, I am separate of the chair is outside of me, and I capture it, so to speak, as an object of my mind. But essentially, God is the subject of subjects, and I cannot make the subject into an object of my mind. My mind only exists, so to speak, as a spark within the greater mind of Hashem, so to speak. And so, I cannot know God the way I know chairs and tables and people. So we need to adopt a different way of knowing. Right? A different way of knowing. And one way of knowing, of course, is revelatory. Right? Revelation. That's one way of knowing. And another way of knowing is through a very deep, intuitive sense of ourselves. Alright? A deep, intuitive sense of ourselves. I might not be able to see gravity, but I can see the impact that gravity has. I can know gravity by seeing the effects that it has on the world. But nobody has really seen gravity, they've only seen the impact gravity has. And so too, I might not be able to see Hashem, but I can certainly see the impact of divine presence in my life. And that impact shows up especially so in the interior consciousness of my being, which we call the soul. Okay? So today I want to talk about five souls, so to speak. In Judaism, it's something about five souls, which are really five levels of I consciousness, God consciousness, five levels that inspire a certain motivation within me and awareness. And this is inner knowing, things that I know. Okay. So, according to the Kabbalah, there are five souls, which for now we'll call five levels of consciousness. The lowest level is called the Nefesh HaBahami. We're starting at the bottom of the board. Nefesh HaBahami, which is the animalistic soul. Right? The animalistic soul. Above that is what's called Nefesh and Ruach. And we are told, according to our tradition, that somehow this consciousness resides within our body. I guess it's somewhat more intricately connected to our physical consciousness. Ruach, which is a higher level, is experienced somewhat like a downpour into us. Neshama is experienced as sparks that enter us. And Chaya and Yechida are considered to be all-encompassing soul, whereby the first three are considered to be what's called Or Pnimi, an inner light. The Chaya and the Yechida is understood to be an encompassing light, which is called an Or Makif. And according to our tradition, the first man and woman achieved the level of Chaya and Yechida, prior to the sin, they somehow had accessed this level of knowing, this level of awareness and consciousness, and after they had sinned, they had lost it. That doesn't mean one can't get sparks of it. We are taught that Chanoch, who's a character in the Bible, says that Chanoch walked with God and he wasn't because God took him. So according to the Kabbalah, what happened to Chanoch? Chanoch achieved these levels of Chaya Yechida, these very high levels of knowing, but he was not able to maintain a physical existence while having such a consciousness, and so he left the world. Alright? Unlike the first man who had this consciousness, and he was able to be in this world with this kind of consciousness. But Chanoch couldn't hold on and took off with this kind of knowledge. Indicating that sometimes a person dies because their level of spiritual consciousness is incompatible with the physical world they're in, and therefore they take off and launch into a higher dimension. Okay? And we are taught that Eliyahu, Hanavi, Eliyahu the prophet, he also attained some of this. And we, of course, hope to attain these levels of consciousness in the world to come. That these levels, these high levels of Chayin Yechida, which we'll talk about, all of these levels today, hopefully, we will all achieve this level of knowing. This level of knowing. We were also taught that it somehow follows our development on a more psychological, physiological level. We're taught that the baby has this level of knowing called nefesh. Not nefesh bahami, not animalistic soul, that everybody's got. Certainly the child has that, the baby has that. But we are taught that the baby has nefesh also. We are taught that by the time you reach 13 and women 12, you are able to receive, capable of this knowing called ruach. By the time you reach from 13 to 20 years old, you should be working on neshama. And around 20 years old, the level of knowledge called neshama could be achieved. So what is all this? So we're going to start at the bottom. Nefesh HaBahami, the animalistic soul, is a life force that animates my brain. What is that life force? What is it? A huge Duracell battery that's keeping me going? What is that life force that animates the ants? The mosquito. What is that life force? That life force is called nefesh bahemi, animalistic soul. And it is the energy charge, you might call it, that activates the brain. Activates the brain. And depending on the level of complexity of the brain will determine what you get. I mean, if you plug a toaster into the wall, then you got a toaster. You know, if you plug a microwave in the wall, you got a microwave. Right? The energy that's shooting into it, the voltage, is basically the same. But depending on the apparatus will determine what you get. We're taught, according to our tradition, that therefore the animalistic soul is that which is activating intelligence and emotions on a physical level. Okay? And animals have this. How advanced it is, I don't know. But animals have intelligence. And animals, I think, have emotions. I once saw a cat. And it was circling another cat that was run over by a car. And I was so touched and moved by the emotions of this cat. I mean, I saw pain. I saw sadness. This cat was going around and meowing with such a sad meow, you know? So there's emotions. I think so. You've seen sad dogs, haven't you? See, happy dog, look how happy he is. Oh, he looks sad. Animalistic soul. And on that level of intelligence and emotions, if that's all we have, then we're really no different than an animal, except for the fact that our apparatus might be more complex on the level of our brains. But there's something that the animal does not have, which is called the divine soul. And the divine soul is starting from nefesh, ruach, neshama, chayichi. That's called the divine soul, the neshama ha'eloki, the divine soul. Animal soul is life energy. But the divine soul is beyond that. And what is that? What is that? That's a whole different kind of awareness that I have access to. Now I must preface this by saying that what I'm about to say tonight doesn't necessarily mean you've got this. Right? And it doesn't necessarily mean that you might not have had it once and lost it. No guarantee that you have any of these levels of consciousness. If you're alive, you certainly have the nefesh abahami. Right? But you could lose these levels of consciousness. But I want to talk about this special kind of level called the divine soul. And what the divine soul provides. Okay? In the morning we wake up and say, Mode ani lefanecha melechai v'kayam, shechazarte bi nishmati b'chemla rabbe emunatecha. Thanking I am before you, King was alive and established, because you gave me back my soul, great is your faithfulness. What we have in this particular little prayer that we say every morning when we wake up, we have a certain suggestion of what soul provides me with. Right? What does it mean that I have this divine soul? What does soul provide me with? A different kind of self-awareness? It provides me with access to information which is not on the physical level, but information that has become very critical to my survival. In other words, imagine you have a dog, and you see your dog, and he's sitting on your beautiful white shag carpet. And he begins to look uncomfortable. He begins to kind of wiggle around. You start to get nervous. You begin to realize that you would not like to see a big yellow stain or brown one on your beautiful white shag carpet. And you begin to see your dog making some kind of decision. He's looking at you, he's looking at the carpet, he's kind of going through some kind of struggle. Right? Now the question is, and this we can't know, we can only intuit, what's going on in that dog's brain? I mean, what is he really thinking? Is that dog asking himself to piddle or not to piddle? That is the question. Is it noble for a dog of my breed to relieve myself in this public area? Is this good or is this bad? Is this right or is this wrong? Would this be abiding with the truth of my own suchness? Would this fulfill my existential worthiness? Oh, doggone it, I'm so depressed. I don't know what to do with my life. I mean, really, what am I here for anyways? Is this behavior befitting my own calling? My ideals? Is this what I've come into this world to do? I just wish I was a cat. And I think it would be much easier. Why couldn't I just be a cat? I don't think we intuit that that's going on in the dog's head at all. My sense is what the dog is thinking is, will he see this? Will it get absorbed into the rug before he notices? Will I get a swift kick and maybe go to sleep without dinner? It seems that the animal functions on a survival level. What it's interested in doing is surviving. That seems, okay, it's intuition, what can I say? But this notion of good and bad, truth and falsehood, purpose, ideals, purity, meaning, these do not seem to be factors in the animal's existence. They do not seem to play a role in the animal's decision-making process. The animal sees a physical world. He's aware of a certain cause and effect. He knows that there's certain things he does and he gets hit for it, and he doesn't want to be hit because that's uncomfortable. Now, I'm not saying there aren't human beings that function that way. Oh, there are. But they're on the level of animalistic soul. If that's the way they function in their life, if those are the only criteria, whether I'm going to get beat or not, whether I'm going to get away with it or not, is the criteria upon which they base their decisions, then I'm sorry to say that it seems like this person is functioning on the most minimal level of consciousness, which is called animal soul. Alright? But most human beings, and I'm sure everybody in this room, has access to consciousness of values, qualities, which have become absolutely essential to your life and to your decisions, and none of them can be put into a laboratory test. None of them will be able to be put under some microscope and say, aha, this is it, I see it with my eyes, and yet I do see it. I do see it. So let's talk about the first level. The first level, nefesh, correlates with action. We will see that ruach correlates to speech, neshama correlates to thought. Right now we're talking about nefesh correlates to action. Nefesh correlates and associated with good and evil. Nefesh is associated with a quality called justice or justification, tzedakah. It's related to kavod, dignity. Kavod is also respect. And now I want to tell you what that all means. First of all, nefesh is this remarkable intuitive sense that my actions can be meaningful. My actions can be meaningful. That's a funny thing to think of. When you realize from a scientific point of view, like one scientist, a man named Headington, wrote a book, and he said that if you were to fill all of Grand Central Station with dust, then one speck of dust is our planet relative to the cosmos. One speck, here it is, folks. One speck of dust is our planet Earth relative to the cosmos. From a quantitative point of view, if there are around 5 billion people living on this speck of dust, then that would mean at best, we'll give it to you, you are 1/5 billionth of a speck of dust. Scientifically, that's the facts, folks. Right? 1/5 billionth of a speck of dust. I mean, songs like Dust in the Wind are optimistic. That's optimistic to say we're dust in the wind. Because we're much, much less than that. But they probably gave it to us. It doesn't sound good. 1/5 billionth. Well, dust in the wind. We're dust in the wind. Okay, fine. Let them think so. It's remarkable. From a quantitative, scientific point of view, that is really what you are. But from a qualitative point of view, I know I'm really significant. I know that I'm really valuable. And I have the right to feel that. That's a legitimate feeling. Why? So here I have this really mishigas in my mind. That I can do something meaningful. Yes, me, the great me, the 1/5 billion speck of dust, me, can do something of real meaning. It's wild. It's just wild. And yet somehow I know that I can. And I know that when I don't, I feel really down. So I'm driven to accomplish that. I'm driven to feel that. I'm driven to express that and demonstrate that. For some reason I know that when I see some old lady walking down the street and she's just full of parcels and packages, and I go out and I help her, right? I know that was meaningful. She doesn't pay me for it. I don't get written up in the newspaper for it, right? I may never see this woman again, and yet, remarkable, this 1/5 billion speck of a dust really feels that that was a very special moment on an existential level. Not just because it was productive, but I did it because I did it, and it's meaningful. It's a very powerful thing. It's something we need. If you were to take a human being and sap them of their meaning, you would die on the spot. You can take a person's water, you can take a person's food, and they can last for a certain amount of time. But if you were really able to take a person's meaning, and they would really lose all faith that there is meaning to their life, I think from the Jewish point of view, you would die on the spot. It's my life force. It's part of my existence. And so imagine there's a guy and he's working in a car factory. And he's got this very tedious menial position whereby there's one bolt in the car assembly line that he was responsible for tightening. It seems like a very meaningless job. And someone says to him, gee, you know, I'm sorry you have to do such a boring, meaningless job. Do you think he'd agree and say, yes, this is meaningless? I don't think so. I think he would say, what are you talking about? It's meaningful. Helping people. And I'm making a living, which I need to do because I have a family, which I need to support. In other words, there's a certain natural tendency within the human being to justify their behavior. It can't just be absurd, chaotic movements. The human being is aware of meaning. Now, I don't know about ants. I've watched ants walk the wall and go up and around and down, and maybe there might be something to it, I don't know. But if I were an ant, I'd go nuts dealing with that. Because I need to feel a sense of meaning in what I'm doing. I need to feel that I'm justifying my behavior. So imagine a guy standing in court. The judge looks down at him and he says, young man, is it true that you kicked that old lady in the stomach? He looks at the judge and says, yes, I did. Are you not embarrassed? He looks, he says, what do you mean, sir? And you did kick that lady. Yes, I did. Why did you do that? Because I did. Now everyone in the court is shocked by such an answer. What do you mean, because you did? I just did. I mean, what would the jury decide at that moment? Guilty or insane? Probably insane. I mean, a normal human being justifies their behavior. Right? Now you wouldn't ask of that from an animal. You wouldn't expect that from an animal. Right? But you do expect it from a human being because you have this funny assumption, this a priori knowledge that there is justice, there is meaning, actions can be meaningful, must be meaningful. And you can't just simply move in a chaotic way. That's just not normal for a human being. And that's an incredible assumption that there is justice in the universe, meaning to actions. And I can be good. And that's a very qualitative sense. Good. What's good? What makes a body which is worth 99 cents on the chemical market good. And yet there's this deep sense of good. We know goodness. Again, we can't quantify it in terms of some kind of mathematical equation. And yet we cannot isolate it and put it under a microscope, but we do know goodness. And we do know justice. And we do know meaning. And we must then ask ourselves, from whence did these qualities arise? With the Big Bang? Or perhaps these are the footsteps of the Creator. If I see something fall, I assume, I see gravity, I see the impact on gravity. The impact of the presence of an absolute reality who has created this world with intention, with meaning, with purpose. The imprint of that, the impact of that reality would be that I would be conscious, or there'd be at least availability of consciousness of these values that can only exist if in fact there is some kind of supervisor that cares about the world and has given the world some kind of intrinsic meaning. Otherwise, these values have no place. For a person who honestly, honestly believes there is no God, then they really have to think whether it's possible that there can be these qualities, these spiritual qualities called goodness, justice, meaning, in a dictionary that doesn't have the word God in it. This is not a proof. Because remember, we're not trying to know God from the deductive, proof, logical mode, because we don't believe that that's really ultimately accurate. But it's a very subjective but honest evaluation of, hey folks, where are we? And who are we? And what are the values that we hold tight to our hearts? And is it realistic to then say that life is meaningful, and on the other hand say, but we're just an accident over billions of years that came out of nowhere and is going nowhere? Is that really consistent with my soul? Is that consistent with what I know? We have to ask some real, honest questions of the values that we live with. And I believe that when a person really looks at the structure of their consciousness, at the fibers that have been woven into their psyche, that I think that a person will look inside themselves and they will see the impact of the presence of God in their lives. So the first level we're talking about is nefesh. It's action, meaningful action, goodness, justification, and on the flip side of that consciousness is reflected the sense of a supervisor, a being that I'm accountable to, an absolute being that I'm accountable to. Now the truth is, at this point, a person could easily say, well, maybe that absolute being is collective mankind. And one could say that. One could say that at this point, they could try and point to that as the force which inspires these values. But let me go to another level, ruach. Whereas nefesh is connected to action, good and bad, ruach is connected to speech. It's connected to truth. And it's connected to a story that I'll tell you just in a second. It's connected to speech because somehow I have this innate, mysterious sense that my words are meaningful. Yes, that's right. These vapors are meaningful. Right? They're meaningful. You can say, yeah, they're meaningful. I, for some reason, don't like when people say bad things about me. Now, my friend can say, bad things about you. It was just air coming out of that tube called human being. I say, no, no, no. There's a qualitative meaning to what he said. And you say, that's ridiculous. Why do you think that? And yet, we do think that way. That words have meaning. And we have to ask ourselves if the world is simply a physical manifestation of some long Big Bang accident, then we have to ask whether there's any ground for that. In addition, We believe, you know, the consciousness of abracadabra, you know, which is what the magician says, it's actually Hebrew. Abra means to create, kidabra with the word. It's also Latin, hocus pocus also means to create with the word. Okay, but abracadabra came from Hebrew. Abra will create, kidabra is the word. In other words, there's a sense that words have a creative power to them. And words can facilitate articulating truths. And it's connected to a story in our tradition, which we once shared, that according to Judaism, when you were in your mother's womb, an angel taught you all of Torah. Wow. And what is this midrash telling me? It's telling me that inside of me, deep in my consciousness, is already a knowledge of truth, of principles, of the suchness of life. Now what do I mean by the suchness of life? Imagine 50 years from now you're sitting there in the living room, reading the newspaper. Your daughter comes in and says, "Mom and Dad, I'm engaged. I'm really happy." You know, I was a little surprised. You didn't know she was going out. But okay, fine. Who's the fella? Oh, he's wonderful, he's successful, he's a very kind. Well, who is he? Well, he's even famous. Oh yeah, who? His name is Mr. Ed. So Mr. Ed. Wait a second, I've heard that name. Yes, sweetheart, he is famous. Yes, doesn't he have a television show? Yes, he does. Isn't he a horse? Oh, Mom and Dad, please. I hope when he comes over for dinner, you're not going to embarrass him. I mean, you know, he's not a horse. He's my fiancé. And I just hope you'll be sensitive. You're freaking, right? You say, what? A daughter is engaged to a horse? This is impossible. Now you look at your daughter, you say, that's bad. She says, what's bad about marrying a horse? He's a very kind horse. He's a very bright horse, and he's famous. You know, you just don't know what to say because you realize that this does not fit into the category of bad and good, right? It doesn't even fit into the category of this is unethical. What do you mean? I won't hurt anybody, right? And he doesn't hurt anybody, but you're just amazed how it's possible that your daughter could just miss the suchness of life. Like, just that's just the way it is. There's a certain is. People don't marry horses. They don't explain why. You just can't. But you know that you don't. And you can't understand why she doesn't know this. And that's a remarkable experience. That somehow, inside of me, I intuit truth. Now, I might not intuit exactly the articulation of truth, and we might be discussing this and arguing what is the truth, but there doesn't seem to be an argument that there is the truth. Right? There's a sense of a sustaining principle of life. And that, once again, is a pretty remarkable consciousness. And there's this feeling like, I want to be with it. I want to be synchronized with the suchness. And on a physical scientific level, it could sound really crazy. It could sound really, really crazy. But somehow inside of me, I am looking for the truth. Somehow inside of me, if someone looks at me and says, your life is a lie, I would take that very harshly. Rather than say, lie, truth. Meaningless statements. You know, I'm just here today and gone tomorrow. Yeah? This all came out of a puff of randomness and blind forces, and that's all. Once again, I've got to be true to myself. And what are the implications of having a sense of truth? So now we go to the next level. On the backside of Ruach, by the way, Ruach is a sense of truth. On the backside of Ruach, I intuit a sustainer. On the backside of Nefesh, I intuit a supervisor. On the backside of Ruach, so to speak, I intuit a sustainer, a force that has established and sustains principles. Now go to the next level. So at this point I'm intuiting by impact. A supervisor and a sustainer. I now go to Neshama. Neshama is connected to thought. Neshama gives me this intuitive sense that my thought is meaningful. And I was pretty hard pressed to say my actions and my speech, but now I really think what I think is important. I'd like you to know what I think. You laugh at what I think. You say what you think doesn't matter because you're just another piece of dirt in the universe. You're just another conglomeration of atoms. And I say, oh, I'm sorry you think that way. And it hurts me that you think that way. I somehow have a sense that my thoughts are meaningful. Now, Neshama is also connected to a number of things. Neshama is connected to purity. It correlates with the notion of freedom, happiness, life, all qualities that we are intensely aware of and in need of. And it's connected to a midrash. And the midrash goes like this. Before the neshama came into the world, it was taken into the Garden of Eden. And it was shown the rewards of mitzvot, the reward of commandments. And just before it leaves on its way down to planet Earth, it takes an oath that it will be a tzaddik. It will be a righteous, pure person. What is this midrash telling me? This midrash is telling me that I am born with this innate sense that I have purpose, that I have a calling, and that, once again, is a pretty weird thing to think. I have a purpose, I have a calling, yes! I am valuable. My existence is meaningful. Not just my actions, my speech, but my existence as a unique being is meaningful. It's connected to the verse in Shema that says, you shall serve God with all your me'odecha, which means all your muchness. There's suchness and there's muchness. What is muchness? Each and every one of us experiences that we are special. We have this innate sense that we are special, and if we feel we're not special, we feel down because we feel that we should be and could be special. It's a remarkable idea to think that you are unique and special. And yet I do. I really feel that. I remember I read this book called I'm Okay, You're Okay. Did you read that book? I read it. And I felt okay. I didn't feel good. I felt okay. A Jewish book really would go, I'm special, you're special. That's really what we believe. Each one created the image of God means that each and every one of us is the image of absolute uniqueness. And I know that and I feel that. And it invigorates me. And if you take that away from me, oh, do I get angry and do I feel hurt? Oh, do I feel that the very ground is pulled out from beneath me? The Arim of Isaac Luri says that if you were to meet an absolute clone of yourself, you would hate their guts. That's what he says. Because you can't take it. Part of your existence is that a feeling that my specialness is a legitimate truth. Wild stuff. Right? Wild stuff. And yet this is something I know. And I wonder, how do I know that? And why is that so important? And if you take it away from me. And yet how can I know that and then say, and I don't believe in a God. I don't believe in a creator. I don't believe in an absolute spirit. But I'm just a function of a long, chaotic production of... It's just not congruent. I'm not being honest with my consciousness. and the implications of these consciousnesses, these qualities, which are so critical to my life. I'm just not being honest. This, once again, is not a proof that there is a God. But I think this is a very strong indication that whether there is a God or not, you already believe in one. And that's very important, to be truthful with ourselves. Do I not realize that by not relating to a greater reality, an absolute reality, a source, an intelligence, a will, a compassionate being, if I do not relate to that being, am I not severing myself off from the very ground and context and root of these values that are so critical to me, good and bad, truth and falsehood, and ideals? What root would there be in this universe of accident for these kind of qualities and values? And so it's important to get in touch with ourselves and just be real with ourselves and ask yourself, so what do I really believe? It's connected to purity. Why? Because when you walk into a store and you see a coffee can that says 100% pure coffee, now next to it is another can that says coffee. Is that the wonder? Coffee? 100% pure coffee. So you look at the price. This one's half the price. So what are they really telling you? The one that says coffee means, you know what's supposed to be in the can? It's not. It's not. It's supposed to be coffee. It's not really coffee. But the one that says 100% pure coffee tells you what's supposed to be in the can is what's in the can. Coffee is supposed to be in the can. You'll open up, you'll find coffee in the can. Purity is connected to a sense of a supposed to be. And I want to know what I'm supposed to be. Now, who says you're supposed to be anything? I know. I know I'm supposed to be. And I just know it. It's a priori. My soul tells me this. Nothing in the universe, from a scientific point of view, tells me this. I cannot prove this. But I don't need to, because I know it. I know it. I know it every single day. And so it's connected to life. Because when you really feel alive, when you're doing what you feel you were supposed to be doing, and you're serving the purpose you had come to serve, which is great. And how many people spend so much money and time trying to figure out what's my calling? What's my calling? Do blind natural forces call out to me? Or is there a consciousness, a great self that calls out to me and invites me into this meaningful relationship where all these values can have meaning because I have such a relationship? So we have a sense of purpose, speciality, supposed to be, ideals, and that gives me a sense of freedom. What does it mean to be free? To affirm my true self, my unique self. Oh, then I really feel very free. Freedom isn't just to do what you feel like doing. Freedom is having the ability to do what I, the unique I want to do. But who says there's a unique I in the first place? And I once had a discussion with this fellow, and he gave me this, you know, life is meaningless, it's all an accident. Right? There are no guiding principles, there are no ideals. So I said, so I guess you believe that existentially, intrinsically, you're no different than a piece of dirt. So he got angry at me. What do you mean by that? I said, wait a second. Why do you find that difficult? I mean, you're basically saying, yeah, it's all, you know, just all came, and we're all atoms and different conglomerations of atoms. And therefore, intrinsically, if all this is bogus, good and truth and ideals and calling and all that, so then are you not simply saying that you experience yourself to be no different than a piece of dirt? And he got angry. It's very easy to say, oh, it's all meaningless, there's no God, this and that. And then you have to realize, what are the implications? What do you really mean by that? And do you honestly live by that? And if you meet a person who honestly lives by that, watch out. Watch out. Okay, so these are three levels of soul, which is considered in Kabbalah, to be related to the inner light, an inner kind of sense of self, which is reflective of a relationship with a greater being, a greater reality. Nefesh suggests and indicates a sense of a supervisor in my life. Ruach suggests a sense of a stabilizing reality, a sustainer in reality. And Neshama suggests a creator. I was created. I was meant to be. If I wasn't meant to be, I would have no meaning. Somehow I was meant to be. I, yes, the unique I was meant to be. So I've got supervisor, sustainer, creator. These are the three, so to speak, perspectives that Judaism has in terms of when we talk about Hashem, the Divine. Now we're going to go to the next level. Next level goes like this. You know, we said that these two higher levels are considered to be Or Makif, which is all-encompassing light. That means there's a certain sense of myself within a greater context. What is it connected to? Chaya is connected to what's called Knesset Yisrael, the collective Israel. Chaya is not an individual soul. Chaya is a collective soul that I share with my people. And maybe I get sparks of Chaya when I'm sitting there and I'm watching the news and they're talking about Greenland and then they're talking about South Africa and then they're talking about the Antarctica and they're talking about Israel and Israel? What's going on? And I don't even know these people. Chaya is that incredible pain I feel when I hear in the news that one of my people died and I don't even know their name, but I feel their pain. Because I feel some incredible connection to my people. I have always felt this my whole life. I don't know why. It could be the child of a survivor mentality. But I feel it's a very internal, intrinsic sense of brotherhood and sisterhood with a people. That I'm not an individual floating in midair, but rather, as an individual, I find a certain sense of myself belonging to a self beyond myself. And this is quite a remarkable experience. Soul gives me the ability to transcend myself and, so to speak, see myself. Animals, according to Judaism, they are not aware of themselves. When an animal is sad, he's sad. He doesn't know he's sad. It's not as if he's aware, gee, I'm sad, I wish I was happy. Gee, I'm sad. Look at that cat. Why can't I be happy like that cat? When the animal is sad, he's completely in his sadness. He cannot transcend his sadness. You can. You can look at yourself and say, I'm sad and I really should be happy. When an animal is angry, the animal becomes anger. But when we get angry, we experience sometimes observing ourselves. Have you ever had that experience where you're yelling and then there's a side of you that's looking at you and saying, you're so stupid, why are you doing this? You know you shouldn't be doing this, and you're somehow in it and out of it at the same time. It's a remarkable experience. Soul. Divine soul. Transcendental soul. The animal doesn't have self-consciousness. The animal's angry, he becomes anger. The animal is sad, he becomes sad. But I can maintain a certain transcendental perspective on myself. Right? It's very powerful. We're going to talk about that in the upcoming classes, how one reaches that, and the importance of that. But right now, it's important to understand that Judaism, by the way, has this notion called reincarnation. Some people don't know if you know that. I remember I met somebody who left Judaism and was speaking to another person who had come back to Judaism. And they were discussing, and the one who left Judaism asked the one who came back to Judaism, so what is it about Judaism that attracted you, that kind of, what initiated your kind of return and interest in Judaism? So she said, I always believed in reincarnation, and when I discovered that Judaism talks about reincarnation, and it's a very integral part of the whole philosophy Jewish experience, I got really turned on. So the other person said, No, that's wrong. I left Judaism because there was no idea of reincarnation in it. And therefore, I sought more Sabbath because I always believed in reincarnation. No. And they're having a discussion when the truth is that this person left Judaism because she didn't know that Judaism does have a notion of reincarnation. So we do have this idea of reincarnation, and it might be hard to swallow right now, but you could be reincarnated as an animal. You could be reincarnated as a vegetable, as a mineral. But what would make the difference? How would you be different from all your cat friends or all your dog friends? The difference between you and Rover and Spot, you're all sitting there, you know, and you're all lapping up your gravy train and, you know, wagging your tails. But you're feeling lonely when all those other dogs don't have that. Right? And you're feeling like, I wish there was a dog here that we could really communicate and just exchange warm glances. And I just feel so lost because I'm a dog. You see, a reincarnated dog knows they're a dog. And a dog doesn't know he's a dog. In contrast to what could have been a cat. Dogs don't think things like, I'd rather be, you know, an island, or I'd rather be a hammer than a nail. Right? Dogs don't write songs like that. Okay? Because there's no such thing as rather. I am what I am, and that's all what I am. I'm Papa the Sailor Man. Wow, isn't it good to have those verses memorized from my childhood Torah upbringing? Okay, so, but an animal doesn't know he's an animal. He's an animal. He has no other options of thought. He cannot transcend himself and entertain these things. Neshama, as well as all the other, Chaya, as well as the other souls, enable me for this kind of transcendence. It's Chaya that asks me to do something quite crazy, like give my life up for my people, which is so anti-individual survival, but somehow I feel that my individual survival is bound up with a collective historical survival. And I'm in absolute awe of people who do that, and sometimes I even feel like doing that. Mesirut Nefesh, giving my life up for my people. And that's really amazing. And that is called Chaya. It's a collective soul. It's only because of Chaya, I think, that we could even be commanded to love our neighbor as ourselves. Why? Because there is a oneness that we share. If you ever looked at a tree, beautiful tree with a tremendous amount of leaves and branches, imagine these two leaves looking at each other. Right? And imagine they now have self-consciousness. And one leaf looks at the other one and says, I don't like you. You cramp my style. Well, the other leaf says, but we're one. What are you talking about? We're not one. Yeah, because at a deeper place, we share a branch. And we're really one in a deep place. And so too, how can I be commanded to love my neighbors myself? Oh, maybe I will, maybe I won't. We'll go out, we'll see, have a couple beers together, shoot the breeze. If I like them, I'll like them. If I don't, I don't. How can you command such a thing? First of all, it's important to understand that when Judaism says love, love isn't a feeling, love is an action. Judaism cannot command you to feel. It commands you to act. The act generates feelings. Right? But love is an action. And so when Judaism says, love your neighbor, love your fellow Jew, that it means do activities that will reveal that mysterious unity, that soul that you share. And Chaya gives me the sense of love, the value of love. Nefesh is good and evil, Ruach is truth and falsehood, Neshama is ideals and purpose. Chaya is love. And I believe in love. And it's so unscientific. And yet it's so critical. When a person doesn't feel loved, they just can't go on. I don't think an animal has that need to feel loved. I think an animal needs to feel fed. Unless it's a reincarnated animal. Right? I've had people in my class that really get upset when I talk about animals that way because they have very intense relationship with their animals. But I don't know. Maybe it's your late aunt. I don't know. I don't know who this dog is. So maybe, what can I say? Okay. But this ability for love, for unity, this belief in love. You know, I once did something which was pretty strong, and I don't know if I regret it or not, but at the time, I did it anyways. I was working with a Jewish organization, and we were having this discussion in the home of one of the chapters, one of the members, and we were talking about life and meaning. You know, I can't help myself, I do that a lot. And we were talking about Passover and freedom and a certain innate drive that the Jewish people and responsible Jewish people feel in terms of human rights. And we were talking about, and all the time, there's this Mr. Stein, who's the father of the home, kind of like hanging around trying to hear what this rabbi is inculcating and indoctrinating into my kid's brain. And you can just feel his presence. He was organizing the flowers, he was dusting off the doorknobs, anything he could do to just be within earshot of what I was saying. And then, you know, we would talk and one of the kids would say something or I would say something and he couldn't help himself but kind of, you know, react like, and I turned over and would say, Mr. Stein, would you like to join us? Oh, I'm sorry, am I disturbing? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just cleaning this toothpick right now. I'll be finished in a second. So I said, okay, fine. Well, we continue the discussion and one of us, you know, the participants made it in some kind of statement, and Mr. Stein goes, you know, I'm looking at him, I'm going, Mr. Stein, whether you want to be part of this or not, you already are, and please join us. And he says, no, I'm sorry, no, it was something else, I'm sorry, okay, fine. Well, finally, we're talking on, and somebody else makes a point, and at that point, he cannot hold himself back. And he, you know, starts being almost vulgar. He says, oh, this is da-da-da, this is, there's no this, there's no that, this spirituality garbage, and this meaning stuff, and this is so, and he was just getting really upset. And he just poured it all out. So that moment, I felt I needed to use some nuclear tactics. And I turned to him and I said, you believe that? What you're saying? He said, yes, I do. I said, Mr. Stein, would you feel comfortable in saying that your relationship with your wife is no different than two dogs sniffing each other's rears? And he turned. You know, now, I wouldn't do it again, but I did it at that moment, with maybe a little reactive of me, but, you know, nuclear reactive of me, but I did it, and at that moment, you should have seen the transformation of this man. He became so poetic, and he started, what are you talking about? He's talking about love, and he's talking about this, and I'm looking at him, and I'm, only when it hits you where it hurts does it start coming out. And like, we got to be honest with ourselves. Chayit gives me this sense of a unitive reality that enables me to feel that meaning, that worth, that legitimacy. I want to be loved, not because of what I do, but just because I am. And if you don't give me that, I feel really ripped off. And my whole life I go looking for it, and I don't give up. Because I just know it can be. But how do I know this? This is really odd for a person who believes in the randomness of the universe to have such intense emotional intuitions that have such a power in their lives. Well, Judaism says this is the impact of the presence of Hashem in your life. and the spark that has been implanted, imbued in you. And now we come to the highest level, which circumscribes all of this. And this is called Yechida. And Yechida is translated, Yechida comes from unit. So you might call it unit soul. Sounds like a great name for shoes. Unit soul. Get it? No, what is unit soul? What is it the Yechida gives me a sense of? Yechida gives me a sense of such personal transcendence that not only would I give my life up for my people, but I will give my life up for abstract attributes like peace, like justice. I would be willing to endanger my very existence on an individual level and give my life towards science, wisdom. I remember reading an article on John Glenn. Remember John Glenn?
Sure.
Who was John Glenn? John was the first astronaut that went out there in the Friendship 7. Wasn't that called the Friendship 7? The Good Friendship 7 rocket ship? Or maybe that's a show I used to watch when I was a kid. Anyways, so he's out there. And what happened was, as he was coming back into our orbit and landing, something went wrong technically, and there was this intense heat that he was feeling in the rocket. And he began to realize that this may be the heat shield that is peeling off, and in moments I will be singed out of existence. Well, thank God it wasn't the heat shield, it was the chili he ate for lunch. I don't know what it was. But he, you know, it wasn't that, and he returned. He returned safely.
You know, we had chili for lunch.
That's subconscious. That's nothing to do with it. And so he returned safely. And so he was interviewed. How did you feel at that moment? Why did you do that? And you know what he said? He said, before I went on that trip, I told my family, there are certain causes in the universe that are worth sacrificing your life for. And until you find an ideal that you would entertain giving your life for, you have not yet begun to live. John, way to go. That's great stuff. I mean, that's fantastic. Very, very strong. What is this I'm feeling? I'm feeling that there are these cosmic, universals, qualities, eternal qualities, which we call the qualities of God. Love, truth, justice, peace, wisdom. And therefore, I experience my individual existence as bound up with a universal existence. An absolute allness. And I'm willing to give my life up for that. And I'm yearning to uncover and expose that inner connection I have with this oneness. And therefore I have a mitzvah to love God. How can you give me mitzvah, love God? I was having enough problems with loving my neighbor. Now you're going to give me love God. What will I do? Go out? Hang out a little? Well, what do you mean? How can I love God? Judaism once again says it's not a feeling, it's an activity. I am commanded to do acts which demonstrate that unity that I have with the One, with Hashem. And that's the meaning of covenant in Judaism, which we'll talk about in the future. What is covenant really all about? And because of that, I feel in some mysterious way a personal connection to God. All embracing life of life, consciousness of consciousness, which I feel an intense sense of unity with. And that's a phenomenal sense of transcendence. Yechida is also the collective soul of all creatures. And therefore I feel a certain kinship with all creatures, because we all exist within this collective soul we call Hashem, God. And therefore I intuit an absolute reality who, by virtue of my connectedness to, gives me an intrinsic value. And if I were to lose that context, I would lose everything. And therefore, I'd be willing to give up my individual life on planet Earth, because I experience that my true I continues to exist as an aspect of, in oneness with, Hashem. So what we have here are some very remarkable inner knowledge, values and qualities, which make my life so beautiful and so exciting and so invigorating. Values which are the ground of my existence. Values which give me happiness and give me hope. And yet, is it reasonable then to say that all of this came out of a Big Bang? Is it reasonable to have a dictionary with all these words without the word God in it? Because if there is no absolute reality which has created the world with will and intention and meaning, if there is not this absolute reality which I in some intimate way am bond with, then there's no room for any of this. Listen to what Nietzsche said. Nietzsche, the great atheist for so many people, you know? But Nietzsche said this. First of all, Nietzsche said, I am more a battlefield than a human being. Now, wait a second. Chill out. What are you so uptight about? Life is meaningless, and go have a beer and enjoy it. No. I can't. Let me read to you something from Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Berkowitz. It's a book called Crisis in Faith. There is meaning in the world, for man knows about meaning. He searches for it. Even when he denies it, he affirms it. Because he denied it. There's nothing to talk about. Now there's no meaning. If he reaches the conclusion that there is no meaning to life, he must have some idea of what that meaning ought to be. Right? And how can you have some thought of what it ought to be if it isn't? And looking around, he cannot find it. Only in the light of some expectation of meaning can he reach the judgment that existence is meaningless. So how could you even have an expectation of meaning if you have not in some ontological way tasted meaning? You must have. You know it inside. So Nietzsche, in one hand, is saying, there's no God. I'm not sure that's really what he was saying. I think really Nietzsche was ripping down the graven image, the conceptual graven image of God. But I'm no expert in Nietzsche. But Nietzsche also says something very, very powerful. Man loses faith in his own value if no infinitely valuable whole works through him. Wow. Listen again. Man loses faith in his own value if no infinitely valuable whole works through him. I want this infinite whole to work through me. The man of prayer wants to be possessed. The philosopher is trying to objectify a conceptual God. But the man of prayer knows God by the experiential joy of participating and feeling chosen to be a tool in the hands of the Creator. To be a channel for the creative spirit of this infinitely valuable whole, which we call God. This is a book about philosophers, so it's not really quotes, but it's about them. Camus believed that life is senseless, but he still endeavored to find meaning for it. Why? His insoluble dilemma is to see a chance for moral perfection without believing in God. Why would you want moral perfection if there isn't a God? He asks, is it possible to become a saint without believing in God? Why are you even asking questions? Go hang out and enjoy yourself. And I think this is really related to what we talked about this morning. God breathed into man the breath of life. I know God, and I know the implications of the existence of God from within myself. From within myself. And the more I explore the wonders of my inner spirit and the implications and the consciousness and the motivations towards goodness, truth, ideals, love, transcendence, purity, holiness, sanctity, the more I get in touch with those inner values, the more I feel the impact of the presence of God in my life.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.